Hi, Charisse here with a special announcement. You can now enjoy select episodes of Detailed in video form. That's right. Detailed is now available on RCAT's YouTube channel. Now, you may be thinking, I already listened to the podcast. No need to watch it on YouTube. Well, trust me, if you don't want to miss out, even if you're an avid listener of the podcast, the video format is a completely different experience. Not only is it like hanging out with us, but you also get to hear parts of the conversation that were left on the cutting room floor. You can also see the photos, drawings, and video as we discuss the incredible projects that are featured. Come join us on YouTube. Follow the link in our show notes, and let's get into the details. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
The buildings, and the tanks, all of that infrastructure, the way that they move around the space, the materials that we talked about earlier, those are all part of the toolkit that we have to say, you know, here's how we're going to sculpt this so that the process of making wine is front and center. And over time, too, you learn how to make wine, more or less. You learn the process.
Yeah. You learn more about how to drink it.
Yeah. All the winemakers who might be listening to this are going to be scoffing at that. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's about knowing a little bit about what Connor and Becca do in their lives. And if you can do that, if you can empathize with them, if you can start to understand what they want out of the process, it makes it a lot easier to design something meaningful. And so the poetry is our job. It's our job to pull the poetry out of the process and pull the poetry out of the space and not be, okay, here's your tanks. It's more than that.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, Senior Specification Writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guests today are Brian Cordy, FAIA, Principal, and Camden Greenlee, AIA, Associate from the San Antonio office of Clayton Cordy, who also has an office in Austin, Texas. Brian, a native Texan, leads the San Antonio office in the firm's residential, ranch, and vineyard-related projects, currently in California, Hawaii, and Texas. With a passion for authenticity, richness, and well-crafted materials, Brian's work champions the honesty of modernism with a commitment to practical yet artful solutions. Since 2017, the firm has been recognized with more than 50 AIA and Allied Awards for design excellence. Throughout his career, Brian's work has been recognized with national, state, and local AIA Design Awards and additional awards from related industries. In February 2020, Cordy was elevated to the College of Fellows of the American Institute of Architects, an honor awarded to only 3% of all AIA members that acknowledge his personal achievements, architectural excellence, and those architects who have made a significant contribution to architecture and society on a national level. Cam, after receiving his master's degree in architecture at the University of Illinois in 2010, taught undergraduate design courses as an adjunct professor for 4 years at his alma mater. The experience honed his understanding of the value of teamwork and design dialogue. Following his teaching tenure, Cam made the trip south to work for another regional architecture firm before joining Clayton Cordy in 2016. Cam leverages his passion for building performance and environmental stewardship to help lead the firm's environmental design process and graphic visualization standards. His current stable of projects include ranch houses and vineyard projects in Texas and California that embrace their connection to the environment. His interests in architecture stem from an appreciation for the subtleties of materials, light, and the procession of space. The project we will be talking about today is the Full Draw Vineyard in Paso Robles, California. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Since 2016, Full Draw Vineyard has risen as a prominent family grower in Central California's wine country, tucked within the Templeton Gap AVA near Paso Robles. In collaboration with Clayton Cordy, the owners, Connor and Rebecca McMahon, envisioned a complex that integrates with its surroundings while embodying the owner's ethos of approachability and sophistication. It all started with a fortuitous encounter during one of Brian's projects at another vineyard.
I met Connor McMahon sometime around in 2016, and I had just finished a project called Epic Winery, which is in Templeton, which is kind of 5 minutes from Paso Robles and closer to the coast. And Connor happened to be walking around the winery when I was there, kind of doing some, you know, really post kind of punch list work. And he bumped into the owner's rep and was talking to him about the facility. And I think they had maybe met kind of in passing once, and he knew what Connor was up to. And as they were talking, I saw them point to me at the other end of the room, and he goes, "Well, there's the architect right there." And so Connor walked up to me and said, "Hey, I'm Connor, and I'm looking to do my own winery over in Paso. Why don't you give me a tour?" So I had a really opportune time to show him around Epic and everything that we had done there and how they were making wine. And we had kind of just kind of hit it off. And then when Cam and I got involved with he and his wife, Rebecca, there was a real synergy there that we were able to build on, and started talking to them about the goals for their project and the process that we like to go through so that it's fun for them. And, you know, it's a lot like designing a house, really, for them. It would, you know, you get into the same types of questions. It's just kind of a different level of priorities. But so that's kind of what led to us. Connor was working as a associate winemaker at a really well-known winery that's right next door called Booker Vineyard, and had purchased this property that's kind of accessed between Booker Vineyard and Catapult Vineyard, which is coincidentally owned by Epic. And you drive down a long driveway through both of their vineyards to get to his, and then it just kind of opens up to these big kind of rolling vineyard vistas, which are really pretty. So, you know, from there we jumped in, and, you know, we're now kind of have already completed first phase, or we're permitted for second phase, and their third phase is their home, which we're meeting with them about next week to try to help them with that.
From a design perspective, the McMahon's goals prioritize blending into the landscape, maintaining flexibility in winemaking, and creating an appealing destination.
You know, from the outset, Connor was all about function over form. And, you know, our goals were to, you know, A, we always try to have a building that's kind of suited to its environment. And, you know, in this case, we wanted that to fit comfortably in this kind of vineyard setting, but also provide a little bit of a contrast. You know, the other thing was to create flexibility for he and his team to experiment and kind of hone their craft, if you will, towards making these incredible kind of Rhone style wines that they're known for. And the third goal was to kind of really create a destination. You know, they wanted to be known as one of the go-to wineries and tasting rooms once that portion of the project gets fulfilled in the area. And I think they've kind of done incredible since, you know, they've started this whole thing.
Well, it's important to mention that they live on the property that the winery is and all the vineyards. So I think they really see themselves as shepherds of the property and constantly working towards developing them. I mean, they're fairly young, in their mid-30s. Yeah. So very young, yeah, a couple who are setting out on this. And even though their ambitions at the beginning were to just the utility, I want to be able to make a specific type of wine the way I want to make it. The question of beauty is, it's for us, it's never, all right, well, if they just want a warehouse, let's give them a warehouse. No, that's not how we're going to work. We conveyed that fairly early on, and I think Connor and Becca got behind it as well and gave us a lot of trust, which is really important. Can't stress enough about the relationship between you and your client, because they're trusting us to see something that they don't, you know, within the limits of what they can and cannot do.
The property is 100 acres of established vineyards, less than 20 miles from the Pacific coast. Having previously functioned as a cattle ranch, the site provided existing infrastructure to work with.
Well, you know, like I mentioned before, this property is kind of cool in the fact that you approach it through two other vineyards that are really pretty. And so once you get in there, it kind of opens up. It's, you know, 50 acres or so of planted vines. And the site where the buildings are located was long before we saw the property. It used to have an old house on it and a garage and things like that. So, but it was on the top of this little knoll that, you know, had a sense of prospect from where it was located. So it was kind of ideally situated for a winery and a future tasting room to look out kind of over the vineyard that was going to be there. He started planting vines, you know, very early. You know, they take several years to mature. I think before that, I think when we first went to the property, there was still a really big male like bull on the property. And previously, this was a cattle ranch before grapes were planted. Some of the remnants of that pasture fencing is still there until phase two comes online and they can kind of spend a little money to remove some of that stuff and do a lot of the landscaping that we had looked at. But so utilities were there. So we had water and we had power to this particular part of the property.
The remoteness may look a little deceiving because you're right in the middle of wine country in Paso Robles. So it's very agrarian, but it's also pretty well developed.
If you look at it from an aerial view, the things are fairly spread out, but you know, there are over 300 wineries in this part of California. So it's kind of, you know, rivaling kind of Napa to a certain degree, which is great for them.
The complex consists of three buildings, including fermentation and barrel aging facilities, with the hospitality building slated for completion in 2026. Understanding the process of winemaking helped drive the design of the buildings and facilities. If you're a frequent listener, you may have heard us discuss crush pads, which served as the focal point for this project's design.
As Brian described, it was on this knoll that was previously developed with a house and garage and barn. And so it has a bit of an open area to it that we developed with the winery. And the goal was to use the massings of the building to kind of sculpt a new little area that we can build off of in phase two that we'll talk about. But as far as the outside, everything centralizes around an exterior crush pad. And crush pad, for those who aren't familiar with winemaking processes, where they bring all the grapes and they literally crush them to extract the juice, and then it goes in the fermentation tanks. And the process was, knowing and understanding that process is really important because you can visualize it in the architecture. And we centralized everything around the crush pad, so that's where it starts. It goes in the fermentation tanks where it ferments. It gets barreled and staged on the crush pad back again, and then placed in the barrel storage for it to age before it's bottled. And so that crush pad is a nexus for everything else. And so additionally with that property is it's in this what's called the Templeton Gap, which is this gap through the mountains where winds just come hauling through most of the year. And so the large fermentation building on the west helps shelter that crush pad and protect people from those pretty severe winds. So that being said, the buildings also has to be very resilient. So all the materials we chose were about low maintenance. We're not trying to lie about anything. We want authentic materials. So what you see is what you get. The structural steel is primed and painted. We have some metals that are allowed to rust and patina over time. And then we use this Kingspan insulated metal panel around the building to sheath it and close it. Also knowing that the buildings around the central crush pad, daylight's really important in some of these facilities. So the clear story windows that wrap around the fermentation space were all done so that you could get even distribution of light anywhere in the facility. And then if it were to be subdivided down the road, if they were to change the way they operate, it wouldn't affect the lighting, the daylight.
Passive ventilation for flexible airflow, ample daylight from pivoting windows, metal insulated panels, and a steel-framed, pre-engineered metal structure all inform the exterior and interior to drive function over form.
The fermentation building, going back to kind of what Cam was talking about, is the kind of the cornerstone of the project. It's this big, open, light-filled space that is all about flexibility and uncomplicated flow and simplicity. I mean, we try to set these things up for the client to have room to change their mind down the line, because they truly are experimenting with every vintage. And if they're always have everything so prescribed at the beginning, then there's no room for kind of expanding their craft. So that building is unconditioned. There's a couple of small offices at one end. So 5% of it has air conditioning when they need it, but it's unconditioned space. They're big ass fans that move low velocity, move the air around. We have some operable polycarbonate kind of pivoting windows on the west side that help to flush the building with cold air at night. So all of that kind of function, you know, combined with this kind of daylight, you know, allows them to like never have to turn the lights on for one, which is really great because you're working in a really nice balanced lit environment, which just feels better than being inside of even if they're really great LEDs, they're still lights. So this kind of open, passive, ventilated space is really the backbone of the project that then this giant covered porch crush pad connects to the case goods and kind of barrel storage building, which is chilled environment. So that structure of the winery is a steel framed, you know, pre-engineered metal building system that is skinned with an insulated metal panel all the way around so that creates that envelope. But the materials on the outside are what you get on the inside. So wherever we have a insulated metal panel on the outside, it's doing double duty. We have some burnished concrete block that's exposed to the outside. It's also on the inside. Fiber cement panels, all of this stuff is able to get wet, and it happens all the time. The floors are always wet. The walls get wet. You need something you're not going to be worried about. Hoses are everywhere. You know, it's a rubber boot environment. So, but they're resilient, they dry, and they still look like they did. So that's kind of the main move of, you know, the material palette on this particular part of the project.
What'd you do for the roof?
The roof is the same as the walls. It's a metal insulated panel. On the fermentation space, which is not conditioned, it's just 2 inches. Really, it's just there to shed water and keep the sun out of the space. But in the barrel storage room where we have chilling to 55 degrees, it's 6 inches of foam insulation that's clad on both sides of the metal.
And the only difference between the wall panels and the other than thickness and the roof panels is color. The walls are all on the outside are all this really dark custom color. On the inside, they're an off-white to reflect as much light as we can get. And on the roof, they're white to reflect as much sunlight. And, you know, planned, each roof is planned to have a PV system that hopefully will get installed in the second phase too, to help generate on-site power.
As previously mentioned, part of the building design included a pre-engineered metal structure. That component required particular attention to detail to ensure proper assembly.
You have to build details around the pre-engineered metal building. It's not the other way. So almost all of the doors, I might be able to say all of the doors and windows that engage with the metal building, they're really pulled off of the main structure using metal framing. So we use like age metal framing to make those kinds of connections that we need so that we don't engage the metal building. And one of the things that comes up structurally for those is metal buildings have a tendency to move differently than a typical structural steel building. They have different tolerances. They don't have different seismic conditions, but they have different seismic responses. I remember there are a lot of conversations with our structural engineer who is doing the not metal building part, and how we were going to engage with that became really important. And the biggest thing overall was just the movement, making sure you have enough fluff between really sensitive assemblies like windows and doors and the metal building itself. It was a huge issue. I think you have to think of a pre-engineered metal building as a skeleton that is skinned on the outside. So if we think of a traditionally framed building, we think of skeleton and skin as in the same layer. In a pre-engineered metal building, the steel structure's on the inside and it's clad on the outside. It's the same thing with the fermentation building and the barrel storage here. So your envelope is actually outboard of the structure, the main structure itself. And that's the portion that you engage with most of the time.
At the fermentation tanks, careful thought went into the infrastructure. Material choices, sense of scale, and positioning for optimal flow all account for efficiency within the workspace.
Scale is important here. We've been fortunate to tour through some breweries too, and they have these, you know, giant vats. Winemaking is a little, at least at the scales that we work in, the winemaking is a much smaller operation. We still have fermentation tanks and there's all the infrastructure that goes into servicing those, but they're much smaller scale and more numerous. It might be a consequence of just the way the winemakers that we work with, the way they want to work. But with Full Draw, we were pretty fortunate. Connor, the owner, knew right off the bat what kind of fermentation tanks he wanted to use. And that's usually one of the big key things we need to understand as we're designing. And so it allowed us to know exactly what scale the tanks were going to be and what they looked like. They're beautifully crafted stainless steel. We marched those just in a little row all the way down the length of the fermentation space, like little statues to winemaking. But knowing ahead of time the dimensions of those tanks allowed us to coordinate all the catwalks and access to the tanks and have how high they're going to be and lifted and clearances and all that jazz. What can be easily forgotten is the infrastructure that supports all of those tanks, that supports all the things that are visible. There's just a big glycol, hot and cold water, electricity, nitrogen, pressurized air, all sorts of things. And we have, and we still do, rely on really good consultants for that work, people who are embedded in that world as a profession. Hopefully we're humble enough to know that we don't know exactly how everything fits and gets put together. But the key for an architect is to answer or to ask the right questions. You need to know enough about what it is that you're doing so that you can ask the consultants the kinds of questions that tell us where these things go, how big they are, what they look like, how they need to be directed and connected to all the different pieces of infrastructure. And that's something you learn over time. Brian's been at it a little longer than I have, but that's pretty key. And if you can wrap your head around that, we look at it as an opportunity. We don't really shy away from, you know, all right, put all the tanks over there, but the building's over here. The buildings and the tanks, all of that infrastructure, the way that they move around the space, the materials that we talked about earlier, those are all part of the toolkit that we have to say, you know, here's how we're going to sculpt this so that the process of making wine is front and center. And over time, too, you learn how to make wine more or less. You learn the process. Yeah.
You learn more about how to drink it.
Yeah. All the winemakers who might be listening to this are going to be scoffing at that. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's about knowing a little bit about what Connor and Becca do in their lives. And if you can do that, if you can empathize with them, if you can start to understand what they want out of the process, it makes it a lot easier to design something meaningful. And so the poetry is our job. It's our job to pull the poetry out of the process and pull the poetry out of the space and not be, okay, here's your tanks. It's more than that.
We don't want to hide all of this kind of infrastructure, but we do try our best to curate kind of these ribbons of piping that, you know, sometimes you don't expect how much there is. You can read it on a mechanical engineer, plumbing engineer's drawings, and you get through it with them, and they're not really thinking the way you are. They're just like, I just need to get from A to B. I got to have these many valves. I got to have this and that, and I got to make it work. And we're like, well, we're trying to make it also look very organized, but expressive. And so all of that stuff is kind of what makes these spaces. If you took the fermentation space at Full Draw and you stripped it out of all of the wine-related equipment or barrels, it would be very sterile. But I think the minute all of that is kind of expressed in there, it animates the space. Those stainless tanks pick up the light from every direction of the room. They keep them very clean. They're not necessarily polished, but they're very focal. And you know, they're pretty much the star of the show in that building. So they ought to be cool. And you know, these happen to be all stainless. On the Epic project, for example, there's a combination of stainless, conical shaped concrete, wood, terracotta. I mean, you name it. And it's all, again, that's just their form of experimentation with different materials to get a different yield and a flavor profile that they're after.
The case goods storage room functions as the barrel aging space and acts as a protective barrier between the crush pad and the tasting room. The space is lined with insulated metal panels by Kingspan, a global leader in high-performance building envelopes. Insulated metal panels are an ideal solution for thermally controlled environments such as cold storage freezers and coolers, food processing, packaging facilities, horticulture, and more. Insulated metal panels are exterior roof and wall panels that are composed of two pieces of steel skin with insulation foam in the middle. While most panels range in thickness from 1 inch to 6 inches, they can go up to 8 inches for cold storage wall panels. The insulated foam core is available in a variety of materials, but the most common options are PUR, or polyurethane, PIR, polyisocyanurate, and the trademarked quad core, self-blended hybrid insulation core.
So the case goods, which is also the barrel aging, it's a refrigerated building. It's pretty simple in its form. It's quite literally a rectilinear box that's clad with 6 inches of Kingspan metal insulated panels. And inside, it's a very utilitarian space. It's meant to be completely open so that as Connor and Becca's process may change in the future and or their quantities, they can shift and move things around as much as they want. From an architectural standpoint, it's kind of a bodyguard of sorts to the crush pad. And it, because it stands in between what's going to be the phase two tasting room, hopefully in the next couple of years, and the crush pad. And crush pads, again, they're pretty wild spaces, particularly at harvest time. They just get crazy. Lots of noise, lots of staining, lots of all sorts of stuff going on. And so the fermentation building is positioned right in between for two reasons. One is to protect the future tasting room from that chaos. And two, it's to give the tasting room a backdrop of what people are really there to experience, which is the wine. And so we designed a little opening, glazed opening within that envelope that's going to align perfectly with the entrance of the tasting room in the future. So as you're approaching, you approach in between the barrel storage and the tasting room, to your left will be this window wall with all of these barrels stacked up against it. So you can see here's where the wine is being stored. And then to the right would be the entrance of the tasting room. And so it's a little sentry building. It has kind of a large role, but it's relatively simple in its structure.
And just like the fermentation building, it has two openings that bring daylight in. One is a channel glass kind of wall on the east side that gets morning light in. And then, as Cam was saying, the windows that are kind of accentuating the barrels to the future tasting room patrons is bringing in a bunch of diffused north light. So again, you know, the idea is that the lights really don't ever come on unless they're working up there at night.
To ensure stable temperatures in the above ground location of the facilities, a chiller plant was employed to maintain a steady flow of air conditioning over the barrels. Thick insulation was also used to mitigate the ranging climate conditions in the Templeton Gap.
The term refrigeration just hits a specific temperature point, but in this case, it's just really intense air conditioning. And the way it's done at the scale of what we're talking about here, there's a chiller plant, a glycol chiller plant in the mechanical yard, which is on the opposite side of the crush pad as the barrel storage building. And that produces all of this very cold glycol, which is then pumped underground into the barrel room. And then there's a series of fan coils. I think there's two fan coils that basically circulate air inside the barrel room and pass it over the really chilled coils. And that keeps it 55. It's really important too that there's 6 inches of uninterrupted insulation around the building. It's continuous. And the reason for that is because there can be big temperature deltas. We're getting into the science of it. Big temperature, I mean, it can be 110 degrees in Paso Robles at the hotter times of the year. And so there can be a really significant temperature difference. And so the more insulation we have, the lower amounts of energy that need to be used to keep that nice and consistent.
The expansion phase introduces a hospitality building that provides immersive tasting experiences, employing both indoor and outdoor spaces. Reflecting the existing winery's design language, the new structure prioritizes resilience and warmth, inviting guests to savor the landscape and the vineyard's offerings.
The winery, as kind of the interim hospitality and all everything facility for them, occasionally they do curated tastings in that space, which is kind of neat from a contrast because the visitors get to be in the belly of the working winery. It's kind of this machine that they're immersed in, and you're getting you're tasting wines while you're looking out to the north to the vineyard. You're getting the sense of smell from the fermentation process, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And tasting these incredible wines. And the tasting room, as Cam lined up, is kind of the next phase that's hanging off of this edge of the knoll that we've kind of reserved that spot for the visitors to have a great view of the vineyard and to take advantage of all of this temperate kind of northern light that'll fill up the interior. And it's a counterpart. It's a lot less utilitarian. It's made for human habitation, you know, touch. Everything's warmer. You're meant to be there. And
if the winery is kind of the dirty, messy process of making wine, the tasting room is the really refined part of drinking it. And it's totally different scale, but we've built in a lot of correlations with materials or using materials from the winery on the tasting room so that there's kind of a big brother, little brother type thing so that they speak to each other. And I think it's props to the owner as well that the vision they had was far reaching, and they brought us in as part of that far reaching vision. It wasn't, okay, I'm going to hire you to do a winery, and then in secret, I'm going to hire you later or hire someone else later to do a tasting room. They've really had a very long-term vision that we've gotten to be a part of. And that has allowed us to have all of these, you know, layered correlations between the winery as a winemaking place and the tasting room or the hospitality building as a a wine tasting venue.
The most challenging aspects of the design involve the precise installation of dynamic fenestration windows and the implementation of the pre-engineered metal structure.
You know, it's a pre-engineered metal building, and so there's a whole lot of standardization that goes into pre-engineered metal buildings that just sits under the surface, kind of guised as customization, but it's really not. There's a lot of not necessarily unwritten rules, but there's many assumptions that go into how pre-engineered metal buildings go together that as an architect, you may not be aware of the first time you do one. And so some of the challenges we had to deal with were, you know, things showing up as part of the pre-engineered metal building structure that were not as we anticipated them to be. And that process was a little opaque for our taste, led to some things, but you know, you work around it. You had to change some framing. We had to realign some finishes. The engineered metal building doesn't change. You can't do much with it. So you have to do what you can around it. Other things were, we were using some materials like fiber cement panels and how, you know, they come in large sheets, 4x8 sheets or even larger sometimes. And so trying to figure out how do we fabricate those in a way where we can control the seams and we can control the alignments, particularly related to a pre-engineered metal building. And so we decided to use fairly narrow, you know, 12-inch strips of vertical fiber cement. One, because we built on the rhythm of the Kingspan panels on the exterior. But two, it gave us the flexibility to kind of get our details the way we wanted to. Similar to things like tongue and groove wood planks. Sometimes we'll do, if we don't know that we can control all of the dimensions, if there's something existing that we have to work around, or if we're doing board formed concrete, sometimes we'll specify random widths of wood so that we can guarantee that the seams at the top and the bottom or the left sides, you know, left and right, can line up with important elements in the architecture. If you say, well, no, they have to be 3.5 inches wide, all of them, then you better be sure that when it goes to construction time, you can really control the spacing and lengths of those boards.
One other thing that comes to mind that is less about detailing is more about installation. We have most all of our windows and doors are from Dynamic Fenestration's Illuminart series, which is a really beautiful product. And they provide top-notch design consultation, technical advice, shop drawings, everything you need to get that product to the site. But installation, we spent a lot of energy trying to help the contractor find someone who would install them. Everybody was nervous because, oh, we're in Central California and these units are being shipped from Canada. They must be fancy. You know, they're going to be hard to work with. And so, I mean, I remember that being a really difficult problem to work through. And I mean, we were making phone calls to other contractor contacts that we had in Seattle and LA and trying to get people that would come up from those cities or from San Francisco. And finally, one of the local glazing contractors agreed that it wasn't as difficult as they thought in the beginning. And so once they finally got their head into it, they realized, oh, these are just doors. They're, you know, it's not a big deal and everything went fine. But being remote, you brought that up earlier, there are some factors that do come into play that are real things to think about. And a couple we hadn't really even thought of until after the project was done. You know, one of the doors had a problem, not dynamic, but one of the overhead doors. And the only people that could service it were 4 hours away. And so it's not a quick thing, you know, when you want to get a ranger to come repair the door or, you know, replace a motor or something like that. So something to think about is just serviceability that goes into everything that we specify. And, you know, that was a situation where we had no idea that was going to be an issue, but now we know. So as we move into all these other facilities, we have kind of head
head view looking at things like that, and we know not to worry about certain things and to think harder on others.
In addition to Clayton Cordy's philosophy of sustainable design, the use of honest materials in passive sustainable practices underscores the project's commitment to environmental stewardship.
It's actually very similar to kind of a LEED process in the fact that the state's kind of code mandate for CalGreen is what they call it, their green building ordinance. We have to meet certain mandatory measures and tiering for this type of facility. They have different levels, and each level has a different set of measures that you have to meet. And then you also have to meet their Title 24 for energy compliance. So with all of that, you know, our project, we had a very manageable set of restrictions that we had to work within. And everything was based off of passive design principles to start off. So the buildings, as we kind of mentioned earlier, were sited in a way where they were oriented properly to take advantage of daylight and breezes and block winds and sun where you didn't want it. And then from there, we also have an unconditioned building, which is, for the most part, pretty energy efficient. The fact that the lighting is all very energy efficient to begin with, but it rarely gets turned on. I mean, it's a low energy and intensive environment.
And where there is required energy, like in the refrigeration portion, you take different measures or different steps to ensure that you're optimizing or minimizing the amount of energy needed. So that 6 inches of foam that goes all the way around the building makes that like a little refrigerator. And we have a philosophy on sustainability that I think points more towards resilience and value and specific to each project and site. And we try and incorporate not a checklist that we can go down and say, okay, yes, we've done this, that, and the other, but we try and embed a philosophy from the beginning to the end about when you're making decisions regarding the way the building is sited and oriented, then you focus on these types of parameters. And as you go down, you keep layering on more nuance into the project to solve, you know, issues of energy use, longevity, material sourcing. That's part of the process. At the end, you know, do we have a checklist of performance metrics and the like? Yeah, we do. But our goal isn't, we don't have this checklist as the goal in our minds. We use the checklist as a set of guidelines. And ideally, and in many cases, I think we do, we exceed certain parts of the CalGreen requirements, Title 24 and the like. Not because it was a goal of ours, but because the process that led to that conclusion had all of these things built into it.
From the inception of the design to fine-tuning the shop drawing process, communication between the design firm and the engineering team was essential leading into construction.
Well, for a while, it seemed like we were pivoting a lot. and you know, which was frustrating, but, you know, also kind of, you know, a challenge to figure out how to come in and make something work with what we thought was a problem. So, you know, there were a couple of examples. Cam brought up the metal building system being different than what we had all reviewed in shop drawings. And after fabrication, they just kind of did what they wanted and it just showed up. And by the time it shows up, you're not changing anything. And so there are a lot of conditions that you can draw as many of them as you want in shop drawings and review those details and get it exactly. Everybody's going back five times back and forth, marking them up. And then something will show up and have these giant plate connections that weren't shown in the shop drawings that suddenly your finishes have to work around that were supposed to touch up just a smooth flange. And all of a sudden there's this big bump out that you have to address.
And these are those assumptions that I was talking about. I think as architects, when we look at something, whether it's a drawing, if it's a drawing, we are assuming, much to our chagrin on this project, that the drawing is showing you exactly what's going to show up. So very visual. That this is two scale. We love it when it's two scale and when it shows real thicknesses. And in this situation, the way the drawings were created by the metal building engineer were not that. And so it's like looking at something in a different language. You're trying to read it, and you don't quite know what it means. And the communication between the engineer for the metal building and ourselves was disconnected. We never had direct contact. So it led to a situation where we thought we had reviewed and coordinated the metal building. And then down the line, we found out that it was changed again in our absence and fabrication had already started. And so it was just this kind of emergency switch. Okay, now we have to bend to this. You know, in the end, you look back, it's like, oh, it wasn't a huge deal. But at the moment, it felt pretty serious.
Yeah. All of those little moments, you know, are probably things that we see, but nobody else pays attention to. So we understand that, and we kind of, you know, pick and choose our battles with. And, you know, the contractor was great about trying to help with those types of things, too. They understood that all of those details matter, not only to us, but to the owner. And so there's a certain limit to what you can do without completely pulling something out and starting over. But I think we made the most of every one of those opportunities to clean it up.
It's the same with the infrastructure conversation we were having with earlier, which is knowing what kinds of questions to ask that, you know, get you down to, you know, demanding people answer exactly what's going to happen. And the shop drawing process is really the time to do that.
We also tend to try to get people like fire suppression installers to thread needles that they otherwise don't typically have to do. And so, you know, there's a lot of head scratching, like, and sometimes, you know, they're on board and they really take extra effort to get something to like really snake through somewhere where it's going to be concealed. And other times they win and it's hanging in a spot where you didn't really want it. But at the end of the day, this type of building, you know, that, like I said earlier, that exposure of all this piping and stuff, it just kind of adds to the narrative, and it's fine.
In retrospect, Brian and Cam found that the most prominent lessons learned involved setting early expectations and the importance of pulling from previous experiences to improve future projects.
The biggest takeaway that I had was to, as much as possible, get ahead of assumptions and expectations and process. I think if you rely too much on the benefit of the doubt, you're opening yourself up to surprises. And to assume that everyone involved in the project has the same goals, values, or even vision as you is a mistake. And so getting ahead of problems, getting ahead of those misinterpretations or those misunderstandings is super important. Don't wait for a consultant to send you something. Get ahead of it and set expectations early. Say, you know, you may on other projects have just routed the glycol lines wherever you want it or wherever most convenient. But here, our expectations are that those will be curated so that when they come out of the slab or when they come out of the mechanical yard, from that point on, we're controlling exactly how it gets from point A to point B. And that's the same for everything, right? Preempting that and making the conversation happen earlier rather than later is always beneficial.
For me, I think, you know, when this project completed and I kind of looked back on it, and we kind of joke about this now, but I said, we are never doing another project with a pre-engineered system, period. Yeah. It is just not worth it. And then, you know, a year later, we found ourselves working on another winery that needed to leverage that system. And instead of like pouting about it, we said, look, what did we learn from the last exercise? We learned a lot. And so we were armed with a little bit more information than we had before. We were prepared for some of those things. We could
speak the speak. When we were talking, we made sure that we had more contact with the engineer that was on the other side of the line, that the contractor kind of like keeps them away from you, you know, the relationship. And it went a little smoother, and it'll, you know, proof's in the pudding. It hasn't gone to permitting yet, but when it does, I'm confident that it'll be a lot of those little nuanced problems that we ran into will be kind of like dissolved and we won't have them. There'll be some other surprises, I'm sure, but we gave ourselves as much help by going through that process and learning from it to, you know, prepare ourselves to get through the next one as best we could. But ultimately, you know, we still prefer traditional structural steel that you can curate every connection in detail. And it's just kind of a collaboration with the structural engineer on trying to keep things smaller that we always go through. But yeah, I would say that, you know, that learning process is kind of the best hindsight that we had on this one.
As an architectural firm with years of experience in designing vineyards, I wanted to know what the number one piece of advice Brian and Cam would offer to another architect taking on a project like Full Draw.
I started working on Epic Winery, which was my very first one that started back in like 2005. That particular client told me, hey, guess what? Your beer drinking days are over. You're now going to be a wine drinker. And I was like, okay, because I had, you know, at that particular time in my life, I wasn't really that versed in what it meant to drink wine. And it's kind of something that's kind of grown with all these projects. But I think that that kind of point in my career opened me up to working on these types of facilities. And I think along the way, you get to know, like, not only the drinking of the wine, like we were talking about earlier, but how they make wine. And the process of making wine is pretty straightforward, depending on which winery is making the wine. But they have all these little nuances of how they want to make wine, which are very particular to them. So I think knowing that process of how they want to make wine, not just how wine is made, it's really what it's kind of like designing a house for someone. How do they want to live? Not how does this person live? And so really being specific to their process, their needs, their goals is step number one.
Second, the same sentiment, which is, I'm going to paraphrase Juhani Palasma, who's a famous Finnish architect. He says something along the lines of, get to know your clients so well that you become them and then design for yourself. And so there's this, the sentiment in there is that if you know the specifically the wineries, if you know the process that they want to employ in their own winemaking, the decision-making is so much clearer to you as to how the building needs to situate itself. And since the process is so integral to the way spaces are laid out on the site or how they relate to one another or where the infrastructure needs to go and how it's routed, that's so prime, such a primary focus of wineries that if you don't understand that, you're really off on the wrong foot.
Full Draw Winery embodies the essence of wine culture, where craftsmanship and camaraderie converge to create enduring memories against the backdrop of land and place. But Full Draw is more than just a vineyard. It's the McMahons' cherished home, a sanctuary where their love for wine and community intertwine. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious, if Brian and Cam had a crystal ball, what they think architecture firms will look like 20 years from now?
We've had these kinds of questions in our office, kind of some impromptu, some not so impromptu, mostly circulating around AI, which I don't think anyone really has a handle on. It used to be 1,000 years ago, you knew what it was going to be like in 50 or 100 years. A change didn't happen very rapidly, but today it'd almost be a mistake for us to answer what we think an architecture firm's going to be like in 20 years because we'll be so wrong that in 20 years, somebody's going to play this podcast back and ridicule us on how horrible we were at anticipating that. But My gut feeling is that artificial intelligence automation, to some extent, is gonna change the way we do things. I don't know how significantly, but the other thing that I think is going to change quite a bit is our methods of fabrication. I don't think it'll be open to everyone, but we've worked with some fabrication partners out of British Columbia who have just this incredible ability to do CNC routing for timber structures. And the sophistication of the fabrication is unbelievable. It's certainly, at least on one of our projects, it's changed the way we deliver the building and maybe some of the sensibilities we have in design. But I think there's a lot of room for growth and change in the fabrication world.
On the front side of that question, it makes me think that, you know, currently students that are in architecture schools are just on the line of where this is all starting. And the educational process is going to transform as well at a different clip. I mean, you're already got classes that they don't even go in person anymore, and it's just all virtual, and you can pipe people in from all over the world into one course, and it's really cool. And so as all this technology starts to inform, you know, the construction world and how we deliver projects, how students come into firms and start to learn is also going to transform. And if we're going to be the ones that have to adapt, you know, it's not like we're going to train them how things used to be, you know, it's going to be the other way around. So it's kind of exciting. It's a little unnerving too. Like, you know,
nobody wants to be a dinosaur.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Brian and Cam. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
On the personal side, you know, it's pretty simple. You know, I hope that looking back that I was, you know, a good son and a good sibling and friend and husband and father and mentor and all that, you know, just to make sure I've left an impression on those who I was surrounded by and loved. And, you know, along the way, I hoped I made them laugh, you know, enough to keep things fresh. On the professional side, you know, hopefully in what we do, we work a lot. And so hopefully I've impacted people's lives, whether it's, you know, to have them live a more fulfilling life in their house or create a facility where they can make, you know, world-class wine. And along the way, hopefully those structures have improved the natural environment versus kind of taken away from it.
From a professional, I think it's to hopefully leave a more beautiful impact. And this seems a little cheesy, but to make sure that when things get built, that they're built more beautifully than if I weren't here. I don't know if I always meet that expectation, but that I think is... And there's some stewardship, I think, of especially natural landscapes, but there's stewardship involved in that, which is to say that we get to work in some pretty fantastic areas. And the first thing that pops in your head when you go visit one of these sites is like, man, don't screw this up. You know, it's already beautiful. How do we only improve on it? And so there's that ambition, I think, is something that drives me to do what I do.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.